in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. On this episode, we're going to be speaking about Flash Rebirth and The Blackest Night with DC artist Ethan Van Sciver. We'll be talking about the Flash miniseries that is showing the rebirth of Barry Allen and bringing it back to the DC universe. But Ethan has also been busy as the designer of the Black Lanterns for the big event in the summer, Green Lantern Blackest Night. They recently released a couple teaser images over at Newsarama featuring Aquaman and the Earth 2 Superman. And Ethan will be discussing those characters in specific and just about the event in general and some of the ideas that went into creating the Black Lanterns. There's lots to talk about as far as Flash Rebirth. We'll be covering various things like Ethan's own artist commentary about the opening action sequence, some comparisons of characterization in Barry and Wally when it comes to facing the Rogues, and a lot of other interesting ideas as the conversation develops, including Ethan postulating what would happen if the DC and Marvel characters all occupied the same universe. Another good conversation here at Word Balloon, where today it's sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. If you're looking for great deals on trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, masterworks, essentials, all the various collected comics, you'll find them at InStockTrades.com, and you'll find them at savings of 35% or more. If you order $50 or more from InStockTrades.com, shipping comes free, and a couple deals involving Ethan Van Sciver, both being Green Lantern stories. Volume 1 of the Sinestro Corps War hardcover, the great event from last year, the standard retail price, $24.99, at InStockTrades.com, just $15.74. Or Green Lantern Rebirth, the same treatment that Johnson Van Sciver doing on The Flash. It started with Rebirth, a softcover edition of the collection. Standard retail price just $14.99 at InStockTrades.com, $9.44. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. You can find the details at both websites, DCBService.com for Discount Comic Book Service and InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. Now, Ethan and I are big fans of DVDs and early movies and TV, and there's going to be a lot of that talk peppered throughout the conversation, and it so begins with a discovery of a change in programming over on the Game Show Network.
Yeah, I was disappointed, as was Ethan, to find out that the Game Show Network is killing What's My Line. Now, I like it at 2 in the morning just to watch, but man, you're so, like, dedicated. You were TiVoing it and watching it the next day.
Yeah, it was like coffee with breakfast for me. That show was very, very important to me. It became important, and I'm not quite sure why. Mostly because it gave me the godlike feeling that of experiencing time kind of sped up and knowing the fates of all the participants involved. Like, I love the fact that, like, I started watching when they were rerunning episodes from 53 or 54, and I knew the exact date of Fred Allen's death. And so, you know, I was watching like, haha, he's got 2 more weeks to go. Not looking so good, Fred. You've got a little cough and some bags under your eyes. Was that a sniffle I detected? And then, you know, sure enough, I woke up the next morning when I knew that Fred Allen had died and turned on the TV, and there was a very somber John Charles Daly saying, oh, this is a horrible day for entertainment. You know, Fred Allen is dead. Now Jack Benny feels like a real jerk, I'm sure. That's a reference a few people will get if you're 80 years old.
And pretty much, or us.
Yeah, or us. But, you know, it was so cool. And then I also was aware that, like, in 1965, Dorothy Kilgallen, you know, was going to die suddenly. And some people believe it's because of a conversation she had with Jack Ruby, and she was holding all this secret information that she was going to spill, so she had to be silenced. And it was either that or the fact that she was popping pills and drinking, like, gallons and gallons of vodka every night. So they found her sitting up in bed, and then just her body just went out. But
it was the Kennedy conspiracy. Clearly, it was the Kennedy conspiracy that was killing her, not the booze.
It was Fidel Castro who was just like Darlene Francis better.
She's cute.
But yeah, so I was waiting for that, and we had just turned into it was January of 1960. Now, if you're an American history buff, like I know you are, and I am. I mean, we were about to elect Kennedy,
yep.
And we were going to experience this. And the great thing is the contestants on the show, always talk about what's going on in real life. They mention it here and there, and you get a little tickle when you hear Bennett Cerf talk about, you know, how they just launched Sputnik and how everybody. I mean, that was cool. And then the hula hoop inventor shows up, and it's like, oh my God, he invented the hula hoop, and you must be rich right now, and smug bastard. But you know, so I was really looking forward to experiencing the Kennedy years through What's My Line, fast forwarded, you know, because they, you know, the show used to be weekly and they would show it nightly, so you got to really zoom through history. And then the Game Show Network canceled it. And I'm utterly, utterly just flummoxed, flabbergasted. I'm completely outraged. And I went on their site and complained bitterly. And so if you go on GSN.com and look up the message boards, you'll see my impassioned post to the people who work behind the scenes at Game Show Network, as if they care what a little guy like me has to say. But I demanded that they put What's My Line back on.
Well, I hope it works. But much like you observing history pass by, Barry Allen going through the same vibe, apparently, in the Speed Force before Rebirth.
I feel sandbagged all of a sudden. I feel like Sarah Palin with Katie Couric. I think I'm up for I'm in for something.
What comic books do you read? Oh, all of them.
Yeah, all of them, all the comics. Which ones do you read, Katie?
Well, let's talk about Rebirth. Like, what can, and I'm going to ask Jeff the same question when we talk. Like, yeah. what was, like, did Jeff want him back? I mean, who really said, okay, like, did Dan DiDio say, all right, Hal's back, we got to bring Barry back? What was the reasoning? Because obviously there's a very vocal crowd out there. And by the way, the book is sold out, and you guys are going back to a press. Congratulations on that. I'm thrilled he's back. Obviously, a lot of people are thrilled he's back. But there are those who will say, well, was this necessary? He had a great death in 1985. Why bring him back?
Well, because we like him. Now, I don't know who. I know it wasn't Dan.
Okay.
If Dan says that it was his idea, it was not Dan's idea. I mean, Dan was talked into it, and I guess in a sense you could say it was his idea if relenting to constant pressure from his freelancers and creative people, it, you know, is your idea. But I used to bother Dan about it all the time because I really love Barry Allen, and I think he is so very, very important to the DCU. He was just a man out of time in his own day, and I think the world, like we say in issue one, the world has finally caught up to him. The world has finally caught up with him. It's his time now. And the interesting thing is, I mean, a lot of the older readers are familiar with him and have missed him for 20-some years. But to the new readers, it's almost like introducing Kyle Rayner to Hal Jordan fans all of a sudden. I mean, this you know, the classic Silver Age Barry Allen Flash is a brand new character to them. So it's going to be our duty and challenge to introduce him to them and make them see why he's different from Wally, why his time is now, what he means, what his return means to the DCU, and the bad stuff that's going to follow in his heels. So I'm very excited about it. And again, you know, I'm sure Jeff did too. I can't remember if we talked about Barry Allen coming back ever during Flash Rebirth. We probably did, but I don't remember now. I just remember me thinking and saying to Dan constantly, look, you know, it's going to work. I mean, if you just let us have Barry Allen back, we it will work. He's been dead for 24 years or whatever it's been. How long has it been? 24?
85 or 86 was Crisis. 85, I want to say, was Crisis.
Sufficient respect has been paid, in my opinion, to the greatness that was Crisis. And let's dust this toy off and play with them again.
Very cool, man. And I'm
good Flash stories.
Exactly, and I agree. And I also think that a lot of Silver Age characters do deserve to come back that might have passed away, because we're at a really good point now in comics where the art is amazing, the writing is amazing, and I would like to see a lot of these characters get their due. And that's not at all a knock against John Broome and Robert Kaniger and the fine people that wrote, you know, The Flash. Kerry Bates certainly had an amazing run on The Flash. Who are some of your favorite writers from the day?
Of The Flash?
Yeah.
The ones that you just named.
All right, there you
go. But, I mean, you know, listen, I'm going back and reading those back issues now. I remember Barry Allen from, you know, Crisis, which was around the time that I started reading comics.
Okay.
Flash died right when I discovered, you know, comics as a real form of entertainment and not just something to rest my silly putty on, which was the way it was before. I have been thoroughly indoctrinated, in Wally West stories. I've been immersed in them. Wally West has been my Flash throughout my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Of reading comics. So, my readership goes, my favorite writers would be Wade, obviously.
Okay.
Absolutely. Grant Morrison and Mark Millar run, which I'm rereading now. It's fantastic. I don't think anyone appreciated it as much as they should have at the time, but it's a lot of fun. And of course, Jeff Johns, who I hate to say it because, you know, he's been my creative partner, it's been like 10 years now.
Wow.
So I hate to say, because it just sounds like paying lip service, but he really did do, you know, to me, the definitive Wally West Flash run. With Scott Collins and Albert Dose and Howard Porter.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those issues. So it's great to talk to Jeff now and hear him say things like, I really don't feel like I got Flash out of my system then. I didn't say what I needed to say about Flash then, and here's a chance to do it in a much bigger way now. With you, Ethan, my all-time favorite artist and collaborator, the greatest artist probably working today. He didn't say any of that stuff. He did in my head.
I understand. Was Iron Heights the first thing you guys worked on together?
Yeah. We were going to do an issue of Impulse together. Jeff came in and, mm-hmm. and wrote a fill-in when I was working on Impulse, starring Star Spangled Kid and that the robot Stripe.
Right.
And I was supposed to do it, but for some reason, some editorial snafu happened. I ended up doing the cover, and another fellow did the interiors. But we were already talking and becoming friends because we both started working at DC at the same time. We were both newbies, and I really liked what he was doing, and I think he liked what I was doing. So we planned something, something kind of ambitious with Flash Iron Heights. And immediately, both of us went to Marvel after that was done. We should have just stayed right where we were. He did. He stayed and wrote Flash and some other stuff. But, you know, I was like, I'm going to Marvel. And he said, well, I'm going to follow you because there's an X-Men project I want to do. It's the Morlocks. And
he did a good run on Avengers as well.
Yeah, he went over and did Avengers. And everybody who was around reading New X-Men then probably can fill in the blanks and figure out what happened. But
exactly.
I didn't draw Morlocks. Somebody else did. But in a way, it was good because I have to admit, when he said, I want to do Morlocks, when you talk to Jeff Johns and he says, there's something I want to, you know, work on with you, you get kind of excited. And then if he says Morlocks, you're like, oh, man. It's like he's got a great story idea, but why does it have to be the Morlocks? And I have to admit, a little of that was going on, but, follow Jeff wherever he goes. He's a terrific, terrific comic book writer and a good creative inspiration to everyone he works with.
Well, and again, I think in the hands of you guys now, Barry Allen has a chance to be told in a way that just wasn't done before. And it was, you know, different audiences and guys were writing different things. Again, I will say, as a guy who grew up with, almost the whole run. I mean, I remember being a little kid in the checkerboard DC 12-cent comics and reading the Flash books because of Infantino's covers, for example, which,
yeah.
You know, obviously you evoke a lot of great Flash moments in this first Rebirth issue. And it's fun to see a different perspective on some of these things. It was really fun, though, to see the splash of chemicals right there at the beginning of the story, because I think that is just such a very cool shot, in a lot of ways more dynamic than Peter getting bit by the radioactive spider, or the Kents finding, you know, Kal-El in the rocket ship, or Bruce Wayne watching his parents die. I do. I always just think that is such an amazing scene with all the lightning going on and just being doused by all those chemicals. So what?
It's really close to a Marvel origin, isn't it? And maybe that's what the Silver Age was all about, because, you know, really the golden age of DC characters, and most DC characters are sort of these self-determined the characters of origin, where it's like nothing really, you know, like Batman, something tragic happened to him, but he chose to do something. He created the Batman, you know, agenda by himself. I mean, Superman is who he is. You know, Marvel characters all get into these stupid accidents. Just have, like, dumb things happen to them. And it's like if the two universes coexisted, the Marvel Universe wouldn't exist because the DC heroes would prevent all the dumb accidents from happening. You know what I mean? Like, Superman would be in space turning Reed Richards' rocket around. Like, don't you know it's dangerous up here, pal? You brought your woman with you?
Or, like, stopping the radioactive machine from exploding so Peter doesn't, you know, the spider doesn't happen. Boy, that was close, son.
Yeah.
Stay in school.
Bruce Banner, you want to not wander around the atomic testing site? Daredevil, watch out. Chemicals are going to splash in your face. I mean, it's like a whole lot of that stuff goes on. And with DC, there's not so much of that. You know, it's always like a gift has been given and I must return. You know, it's not like something tragic happened to me. And, you know, it's always something more noble. So, yeah, Flash's origin is interesting because it does seem like, upon first glance, one of those Marvel accidents.
Mm-hmm. Although, again, it obviously predated the Marvel Age because, and I think it was, forgive the word, the zeitgeist. What's that?
Do you think it inspired the Marvel comics? I mean,
you can go there, but I think I was going to even say, and I've heard Stan Lee admit this, that I think it was just in the air with all the science fiction films of science gone wrong. And and I think it was Julie Schwartz's intent, and also the other creators as well. They were all sci-fi fans, and that was the idea of making them different from what had come before. And, you know, I mean, and, well, and even, really, actually, I guess you can even say Jay Garrick's speed came from science as well. It was the hard water experiments, I guess.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It doesn't work anymore. It worked then. It doesn't work now. I've tried it. Don't bother.
You know, I got some hard milk that I left out for a little while, but I never tried hard water. No, I don't know how that works. You know, I want to go back to Impulse and ask you a question. When you've got guys that have all worn the red classic Flash suit, do you try to make, you know, there's, you know, what happens when both guys are wearing the same suit, but you're trying to, you know, identify the fact that they're two different guys? I know it happened during Mark Waid's story during that Return of Barry Allen, where we saw two Flashes running around, and you had a different shade of color for the uniforms and stuff. But are we going to see a moment where you can really, you know, see the difference, even though three different guys are wearing the same suit?
Well, Bart's not wearing the suit.
Not right now. Well, I was just wondering if there was going to be that kind of moment, or even just putting it between Wally and Barry.
Yeah, we're gonna do something to pretty much drastically separate those two characters.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there will be that moment. Because I mean, historically, you know, one must recall that, you know, Wally West is wearing the Barry Allen suit because, in tribute to Barry,
right,
his, you know, his fallen mentor and friend and uncle. I mean, you know, now that Barry is back, it's, you know, there's no real reason for him to be dressing like him anymore.
Right.
So part of this is going to be setting up the distinctions between all of the characters, you know, visually and then every other which way.
Mm-hmm.
My job is going to be visually, obviously. I'm going to leave the rest to Jeff. he knows better than I do.
Okay.
About things like that. But yeah, I mean, these guys are all, you know, a brotherhood, and they all sort of share the same lightning, and you know, we're going to, by the end of this series, hopefully, you know, each will have their purpose, and Barry Allen will be very clearly defined for a new generation of readers, and you'll love him.
Well, and I know you have said before, too, that you were designing a new costume for Wally, and of course, once again, the Internet roared.
And I know. The Internet roared sort of like, well, I don't think there was outrage yet with the idea of Wally wearing a new costume. I think there's mostly, it was a roar of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
but they will be sated, and none of them will be alarmed or upset because I don't believe in making outrageous and difficult to swallow changes to characters. I don't believe in it. I think everything sort of has to follow a train of thought mm-hmm. that was begun by whoever, started the train. So, we know what Flash characters look like. We know what they are. We know who Wally West is.
Okay.
If you can get inside Wally West's head for a moment and see what it must be like to be him right now, certain changes to his costume would preclude themselves, and others would become pretty clear. So I have to be very, very vague about it.
I understand. No, I understand. And then really, I was even thinking of the classic Barry Allen suit being worn by the different guys. I know, like I said, we know you're going to have a new design for Wally coming.
Yeah.
And that'll be fun to see. And also, it's interesting to see within the story that all are still linked to the Speed Force and in a very unique way now that we haven't seen before, and certainly shown by the big lightning charge that happens at the end of the story that seems to affect everybody, including yeah. Wally's kids,
yeah.
including Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
So that's going to be, yeah.
Liberty Bell used to be Jesse Quick, for anyone who hasn't been following JSA. So, and Jesse Quick, of course, the daughter of Johnny Quick, and all tied into the Speed Force. So, yeah, that's where we're going here.
Sure.
We're going to explain why and how.
No, and that's it. I think you guys have set up an interesting mystery, several interesting mysteries. We've got Barry coming back and trying to figure out who really murdered his mom, the one case he never solved, he says.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of interesting. I also like, and I'll talk to Jeff about this idea that Barry was ahead of his time, literally, in the 50s, and now has come back, and, when he's talking to Hal, they make the comment that time and the society is actually catching up, and how we are such a fast-paced society and stuff, and the Flash is still faster, but actually information is right behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, I like that. I like that. I can see that on several levels working, that information might be right behind him.
Yeah. Very neat. I'm very excited about the first mystery that you mentioned, about going back into Barry's past and talking about Barry's mother and his father. I think a lot of people are confused by that, and I think it's one of the most amazing things Jeff's ever done. And I think by issue number 3, a lot of people are going to go, "Oh my God!" And that's all they're just going to say, "Oh my God!"
Cool.
And then they're going to say, "Why did we doubt Jeff Johns for one moment?" Jeff Johns has read every Flash comic book. He knows of and anticipates your thoughts. On certain things here. I won't get into specifics.
And I understand.
There's a reason for all things. Well, it will all be made crystal clear.
That's cool.
In a brilliant and entertaining way.
Well, in that in mind, and all right, here are a couple of my stupid fan-based questions. It's one of them I wanted to ask about was, in the middle of the traffic jam, there's a car that very clearly has a bumper sticker that says, "I don't brake for anybody." And the license plate is ERK. Is that a clue? Are we supposed to know who that is?
Wow, you're so cool. No, well, that's actually a friend of mine.
Is it really?
Again, yeah.
I was wondering if it was like Robert Kaniger had some first name that we never knew about. Yeah, actually, that's Earl Robert Kaniger, and
yeah.
That's kind of a how much of
no,
a.
There are lots of little things in there that are actually, Easter eggs to be hunted out and clues, but unfortunately that's not one of them. That's just somebody who said, "Would you mind putting my name in there somewhere?" And was able to do it in such a way that it didn't get yanked out, because the clock on the wall in the opening scene was a Spencer Beck brand wall clock, and Spencer Beck is my art dealer.
Okay.
And editorial found that his name being on the clock very distracting, and they removed it, much to his utter disappointment. You can't slip them all through. But I did put me and my wife and son in there.
Very cool.
Yeah, we're watching the Flash parade go down.
Oh, that's excellent, man. That's very cool. And, you know, I hate to admit it, and I'm only pointing it out because I'm embarrassed by this. I didn't realize this, but in the latest Powers trade, either Brian or Mike Oeming put in that the public high school that they're walking out of is John Suntress High School. And I had no idea. So the things you gloss over without even realizing it, and it really, somebody's like, hey, man, that's cool that you're in the Powers trade. And I'm like, I am?
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I was really, I'm like, oh, guys, I bet you did this like 8 months ago. I'm so sorry. I'm like, thank you.
And I always do that in comics. I actually just had a big conversation with my editor about this and why we're not going to do it. You know, it's like you see road signs, and it's like, you know, Kirby Way.
Sure.
It's like, you know, it was cute the first, like, you know, 500,000 times. But now at this point, it's just like eye-rolling. It's like, yes, we all revere, you know, these great men who came before us. But perhaps the best way of showing that is to do good comics and not name fictional streets after them. However, that having been said, I've decided that the courthouse that you will see briefly in Rebirth number 2 is number 4 Showcase Avenue.
There you go.
And that, I think, is a classy tribute to the greatness of Infantino and those fellows.
That's really cool. You know, I'm kind of said it, and it's true. It's like there's still kind of a question of who really came up with what part of the Silver Age Flash. I mean, Joe Kubert is in there, and certainly Julie Schwartz is in there. And it's all these guys kind of who added their moment. I don't know if Kaniger or if it was John Broom or Kaniger who wrote that first story. I can't even remember.
It's not credited?
Well, it's, I guess, and I've noticed this in those Tomorrow's magazines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every now and then they'll interview somebody that was involved, and it's like, yeah, I know what the book says, but I did this, and I did, you know, I designed the Flash costume. I know,
whoa.
You know, I think Infantino, part of his litigation, and I don't know where it is now with DC, was that, you know, obviously he designed the suit, and I know he is given credit, obviously, and clearly that's his book that he's the main artist that Showcase for.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, I did. Oh, he's suing? Why is he suing anyway?
You know, it was all very vague, and I think it was just kind of along the same lines of when things, you know, fall out of copyright, he's just kind of hoping, I think, to get a payment in the same way. I mean, you know, they keep extending the copyright acts, and these guys, you know, yeah, that survived and are living long enough to go back to that pre-1993 Sonny Bono act or whatever year it was that they came up with that. You know, it's, hey, all right, this, you know, technically wasn't work for hire. It wasn't my idea. So, and I don't think it's done with any real animosity. I think he's, you know, just looking to get paid. And I don't mean it in a crass way.
Well, 40 years from now, it will be out of animosity when I sue Marvel Comics to retain the rights to Glob Herman from the new X-Men. They will hear from my lawyers. I demand.
You are on notice.
My control over that character.
Not to wish your death or anything like that, but I almost hope you're a disembodied voice or something, and like you're in a glass jar or something, and it's like, you know, the spirit of Ethan Van Sciver is here to collect his money if it's possible, please.
Absolutely. I'm making a list of every little nonsense character I've ever created for my estate to sue and torture DC and Marvel over for the rest of their existences. Company.
Well, let's talk about some of the things you did design. I like the Flash Museum, obviously, and that's always fun to see. And that's got to be a good...
What is with the Flash Museum? I'll never understand that.
In what way?
Well, I honestly, you know, first of all, it doesn't appear to contain really any artifacts, just giant pieces of art about the Flash. Like, if I went to the Flash Museum, I'd want to see, oh, these are his original boots. Look at that, you know.
Sure.
Or look at that. It's Weather Wizard's wand that was captured by the police department and donated to. No, it's just big statues and big paintings and things like that. But not only that, that doesn't bother me half as much as the fact that there are all these glorified giant figures of like local murderers. I mean, really, it's odd. You know, it's an odd thing that the citizens of Central City wouldn't be like terrorized or embarrassed or something over the fact that, you know, they are the town that raised up, you know, Captain Cold. Instead, they have a whole big, beautiful building with Greek architecture, and inside you can see a giant statue of Captain Cold and read about, you know, his first appearance. That doesn't strike you as weird? I mean, I'm partially responsible, granted, because
clearly.
I reinforced it in this issue, but I don't know. I suppose there's something similar, and you know, around the Smithsonian area in Washington D.C. But if there is, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah. I don't think there's a John Gacy wing, or you know, I mean, any terrible, you know, yeah, mass murderer that you could think of, or
yeah, the Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, public library, you know,
Jesus.
It doesn't really. I don't know. It's odd. Like there is nothing like it in reality. But I guess it's just because they're so proud of the Flash, and maybe it's because, you know, they're seeking tourist dollars from the, you know, wealthy people in Metropolis to come to their city. Because if I were in Metropolis, I'd be like, I'd go there out of morbid curiosity. It's not like they don't have their own problems in Metropolis. They do.
Sure.
They have, you know, intergalactic imps and things like that to deal with. But I would, in a way, out of schadenfreude, come to Central City and be like, look at these punks that have been terrorizing you. Like, at least we have, like, alien menaces that come and bother us, and what can we do? But really, can't you all band together and, you know, make a citizen's arrest of the effing weather wizard?
Or stop the guy in the blue parka?
Yeah, come on now. So, anyway, that's the thing. I will continue with the museum and not argue about it. Like, I could probably, like, argue with Jeff about it and say, why don't we just burn this thing to the ground? But I won't because, you know, I think a lot of people haven't thought about it that carefully and think it's warm and cute and cozy. So
Did you see the Justice League episode where they really focus on the whole hero worship issue of the Flash and why is this happening?
No.
It really was good. I forget who wrote it. I bet it was J.M. DeMatteis, and someone will look it up online and correct me via email, I'm sure. But it really was great, and it had the Rogues. It's this very good either third or fourth or fifth season of the Justice League, and it's...
I have to watch those DVDs. I have them. You know, I'm not,
you have everything.
I'm not crazy about animated material. I have a hard time. Like, I admit... that, like, the Batman cartoon is superior in every way to the Super Friends, but they both hurt my head. The new one? Yeah. Well, all of them.
Okay.
All of them. Do.
Well, yeah, the classic 90s one. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I have it, and I can watch one of them and enjoy it, but I can't watch two of them.
Interesting.
In a row.
That's
and I have
really
Batman
interesting.
On that it's like I'd like to know the contents of these DVDs I bought, but I, you know, I don't know.
That's
always something else. There's always another Ed Wood movie that I found.
So, but in general, animation, I mean, or is it just specifically superhero animation because
no,
you're illustrating?
It's all animation that isn't funny.
Very
I
interesting.
Mean, I love Popeye. I love Bugs Bunny. The Simpsons. I like The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
It's when animation tries to be serious and sort of duplicate, I don't know, the way human beings interact with each other. It's just odd to me. And the superhero cartoons, the voice acting just grates on my nerves because everybody talks like this all the time. Everybody's and the women, they're all tough. The women are all tough, but they look like little children. But they're tough. And it, you know, I don't know what it is. It's a combination of a lot of different factors. And then my next door neighbors, who are art students, okay. So they've had me over there. Look, we want to show you our drawings. Oh, look at your art, sure. And it's like 1,000, like, sketches of, you know, like life drawing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a naked hippie turned in four different directions, you know. And it's like you can look at that and go, oh, you know, you're really pretty good. Good job at that. But then they have stacks of them. Like, you have to go, they're all the same. But anyway, you know, they're asking me to come over all the time to watch this anime thing. And I can't even remember what it is, but I can't distinguish it from Pokemon in any way. I'm sure it's incredibly different from Pokemon. But, I mean, not to my eye, it isn't.
I understand.
And I've seen some Pokemon. I don't want... No, it's good. Who cares if it's animated? It's the storytelling. I mean, I know. That kind of argument should work on me because I'm a comic book artist. But at the end of the day, it's just not my thing. I mean, I would prefer at any time to sit down and watch an old movie. And it would be really hard to get me to watch Appleseed or Bubblegum or whatever these weirdly titled tentacle porn things are with people and robots penetrating prepubescent young women. With,
yeah.
It's odd.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I'm sorry. If you do get it, I'm sorry.
No, I understand what you're saying. I will say, though, for honestly, the 90s Batman cartoon and really everything that has come since then as well, Justice League, Batman Beyond, the voice characterization is so much better. And Andrea Romano, who is the voice director, she's been on Word Balloon, and she is a theater person and really, I think, to her credit, got real actors to do the voice parts. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because if you watch that Disney XD or whatever the hell it's called now, but what used to be Toon Disney, and you watch those 90s cartoons, yeah. That's exactly what you're talking about. That really loud, just like, I'm talking to four-year-olds, so I really have to talk like this.
That's correct. That's exactly what it is. Everybody talks like that. The police talk like that. Every character. But listen, I will say this, because you just reminded me. I watched New Frontier.
There you go.
With my wife, and it was actually extremely entertaining.
There you go.
I wouldn't watch 16 hours of it, though.
I,
you know what I mean?
Oh, I understand what you mean, and I agree with that.
Yeah, it's just long enough. So people who sit there and watch all of, you know, one of these strange chat, and I don't want to punish, you know, the DC animated stuff by comparing it with the animes. I don't, because it's completely different. It is good. It's just I can only take it in small doses.
I understand.
The other stuff I can take none of in any dose. And I see the people who can take it in doses, and they're walking around with these gigantic styrofoam axes and swords with pink hair and bizarre, brightly colored costumes that they made themselves at conventions, and I applaud them. But I don't. I can't. I don't think we could have a conversation. Me and those people. Anyway, I'm just trying to say, in my own passive-aggressive way, to my neighbors that I don't want to come over and watch their cartoons, and I hope they hear this so I don't have to answer them directly.
Excellent. Well, if we've accomplished anything else, I hope that at least happens for you in a very nice way. That's good.
Why don't you just tell me to shut up, John?
No, I like this. This is, and honestly, I just think it's fascinating because, and you even like covered it, but just that, yeah, you're an illustrator. You illustrate comics and stuff, and that, you know, there's been these very interesting animation things from the Fleischer Superman and stuff. And like you said,
I like that stuff.
Yeah, you can. Well, yeah, that I guess is more classic old movie type stuff too.
Still, no, you know what? The Fleischer stuff, I still one at a time.
Oh, I understand. No, and that's what you're saying, one at a time, which I completely appreciate. Oh yeah.
Popeye, just leave it running all day. See the Fleischer Popeye?
Classic.
Leave it running all day. Bugs Bunny, leave it running all day.
Classic.
It's funny. It's cool. You know, even The Simpsons. I'll watch Simpsons. I'll watch like 10 episodes of Simpsons in a row if I have to. There's just something. I don't know what it is. It's just, you know, my comics, the comic work I does doesn't come from, I think, where other comic book artists draw from. Like, I don't need to see superhero movies. That's the other thing. I didn't see Watchmen.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Interesting.
Yeah, did you?
I did. I liked it a lot. I gave it 3 out of 4. I think it is, you know, as tough to adapt as Terry Gilliam believed. And yeah. I think for the effort that he did, I won't go into nitpicks. I liked it well enough. And it kind of dragged, but it only in the sense that it was so faithful to the story that there were just parts of the, you know, times during the story where there wasn't a lot of action. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this, you know, just conversation movie. So I never was bored, but I did kind of feel in the third act that it was like, all right, let's go. You know, let's wrap it up.
How did they deal with the rape scenes?
The rape scene was very brutal and very real and a hard R. You know what surprised me, though, was, and I feel this diminished the character, and maybe it's because they felt that Malin Ackerman wasn't up to the role, or maybe censors felt, look, we're letting you get away with all this violence, we're making it a hard R, but can we lose the Electra complex between Silk Spectre and the comedian? And I felt, you know, and I don't mean in the overt, like, dirty sexual way, but I just mean in terms of that, yeah, there's this father issue that has been plaguing this character, and you got a little bit of it, but what I didn't see was once the realization's there that the comedian is her father, that, at least in my eyes, in Dave Gibbons' art, she looked more and more like Eddie Blake. After realizing it. And going back, I could kind of see it as well. But I think especially once she realizes that that's her father, she is like centered in a way that she wasn't before and is more comfortable with herself.
What an amazing observation. Have you mentioned that to Dave Gibbons and asked him?
I haven't talked to him since the movie came out. I did talk to him a couple times before the movie came out, and am looking forward to our next conversation, and I want to give him a chance to, like, get over the, Andy Warhol fame bubble.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I could appreciate, I'm sure he's, like, in Uruguay or whatever promoting the film right now, so... You know, let him get back to a normal schedule, and then I will get him back. But yeah, he was really cool, and I'm very happy for him to enjoy, you know, even just the awareness. And obviously, whatever the film did, it obviously helped the book. And you know, book sales are ridiculous, and I think that's great.
Yeah, we sold like a million of them. I mean,
yeah,
good God. I know they're timing a Flash Rebirth hardcover to come out and for the Green Lantern movie, which I think is going to be a good thing.
I think that's awesome.
I hope it'll be a good thing.
Now, are they looking at, and I know there's probably like non-disclosure things involved here or anything, but if you can't talk about it, but, you know, are they reading Rebirth? Are they reading, you know?
Well, I'm sure they are. Last year I was approached about it.
Okay.
I said, sure. And I haven't really heard back. So, I think they're going their own way about it. I've got to be honest with you. I think I'd rather just see what they do. I'm not sure I have anything else to say. Like they can draw from, if they were inclined to, what I already did. But I mean, if they ask me to help out and contribute any ideas, I mean, I would just repeat myself.
Okay.
So I'm interested in seeing what they do. Although, as you and I discussed earlier, I think it's ill-timed with the live-action Smurf movie coming out around the same month. Your idea of changing the way the Guardians look drastically is probably the way to go.
Yeah, we were saying that, Ethan was concerned that obviously if there's, like, midget blue people in the Smurf movie, maybe actually seeing the Guardians as serious midget blue people isn't the best thing.
Comparisons will be drawn and made.
I think, I was saying I hope that it's going to be kind of like the way Marlon Brando was as Jor-El in the Superman movies, that it's more just kind of this ethereal kind of projection or whatever of, a face. And that we don't necessarily need to see the Guardians as physical beings.
No, we never need to see that. You're exactly right. I think one of the cartoons that I did watch, because Jeff said I should, was an episode of Superman where Green Lantern shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what it was. I think it was Kyle Rayner.
It was, yep.
And he met the Guardians, but I think at first he met their floating heads.
Yep,
and
I think you're right.
And that worked really well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that might be something.
Well, and I told you, too, at WonderCon, I met a great artist, Simon Thorpe, who has done work for the Harry Potter films and a few James Bond movies and some matte paintings for Stargate, was given one of the guys that at least is working on conceptual art for the movie. And he didn't have any sketches with him, but based on some of his other work, it's like, well, this guy's a talented artist. I'll be curious. I'll just be interested, because it's that whole from leotards to whatever the movie version of the comic book becomes.
Fabric armor.
Yeah.
That's what they do with all of these superhero movies. It's fabric armor or leather. With Green Lantern, may I make a suggestion over the air?
By all means.
And maybe somebody will hear this, but they'll probably just say, oh, shut up. Why does it have to be fabric with Green Lantern? And we go through great lengths to sort of explain to people that his costume is not made of fabric, it's made of green energy. So wouldn't it be interesting to do a kind of Tron effect of his costume, a projection that glows?
Wow.
Rather than some padded football uniform, leotards. I mean, it's just what I would do.
Well, and certainly there has to be some sort of moments where you do get that effect when he's, either firing the ring off or even just kind of floating or whatever. I hope there is some sort of green aura around him, but I like that Tron
not
thing.
Just around him, the suit that he wears.
I understand what you're saying. No, I think that's an interesting leap. I think that's cool.
It would be glorious to see. If I could see that, I'd be happy. I wouldn't care what happened in the movie.
I kind of was expecting a more, contemporary take on Guy Gardner's outfit.
Mm.
And just kind of like a leather jackety kind of... and again, keeping with the test pilot motif, too, and that maybe it's just kind of more that look, as opposed to, you know, the leotards and everything. So
yeah. Oh, I can't wait to see what they do. Now I'm getting interested.
and I honestly, I saw the preview for the Green Lantern cartoon on the Wonder Woman DVD, and that looks really cool.
What is that?
This summer. That's the next animated movie that DC's going to do direct to DVD.
What is it about?
Yeah. It's it sounds like it's Secret Origin. It's Sinestro training hell.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Very cool. So well, I will be interested in that. I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet.
It was good.
Was it good? Did Gail Simone write that? Did I hear or no?
You know, I keep forgetting to check the credits because I came in like the first 10 minutes of Friends watching, and like an idiot, I didn't think to ask or look at the box, and I kind of assumed that she had some input in it. But it was very, very 300 like, and very much in a good way, a cool Amazon story. So you know, it was amazing, dude. If I can cross streets and go to Marvel, the Thor versus the Hulk.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Best cartoon, and it's only 45 minutes long. So yeah, it's not, you know, it's not very long or whatever. But seriously, like a really good attempt to animate the Kirby Asgard designs, and everybody that you want to be in an Asgard story is there. And I was like stunned at how good it was. And again, not the annoying anime talking to 4-year-old, you know, character reads. I mean, really. And I really think that DC has been doing better in general with animation than Marvel. But I liked the Doctor Strange one. For the last two or three that they've done, including that Avengers Next, I just think the product has gotten better and better. And this double feature of the Hulk versus Wolverine and the Hulk versus Thor are great, but to me the best of the two is the Thor story. I just think it's amazing.
Oh, I'll pick it up.
There you go.
I trust you, John. You have good taste in all things.
We really like a lot of the same DVDs, so that's, you know, yeah, there you go. Although, again, I think it's really interesting. I think people are really going to be fascinated that of your general feelings towards animation. Well, let me ask you, what do you use to inspire your action scenes?
I don't even know.
Okay.
Maybe I'd be better at action scenes if I watched a lot of Die Hard and slowed it down and copied frames for my TV. I just don't even think of like that way. I have seen enough movies to have what I think is a pretty strong cinematic sense in my storytelling. And I just draw from somewhere else. It doesn't really come from the zeitgeist necessarily.
Okay.
You know what's going on. The Matrix had no effect on me whatsoever. You know, it really didn't. I saw it much later.
Sure. Okay.
But it wasn't my thing. And the other thing is, it might just sound like obstinance, but I don't want to be influenced by outside things. I think there's a great sense here. This may be the reason why I don't rush out to see superhero movies. I think I'm really annoyed when I see these wonderful creative people who I know and love working in comics who immediately rush out to go see Hollywood superhero movies, and there's a sense of, oh, let's see them do it right. You know what I mean? Let's see Hollywood do Batman correctly, or Iron Man or the Hulk, and then we all come back and go, whoa. I don't want that kind of impact on my work. I don't want to imitate anyone.
I understand.
I don't want to draw from what other people are doing. It's why I don't read too many comic books anymore, because I'm not afforded the luxury of being a fan anymore. I'm supposed to be providing original content as best as I can for readers who are spending now $4, my God, cover price on one of these magazines that takes 20 minutes to read. It better come from somewhere that is original and unique, and it better be as Ethan Van Sciver-y and Jeff Johns-y as possible. You know, so I try to just keep all this stuff away. I try to keep everything at bay and just sort of think on my own and find my own approach without too much help from what I see to be the outside world. And I want to see other creators do the same thing. I think a lot do. But I think when we worship other media forms of these characters that we work on, it doesn't lead anywhere good. It doesn't help our contribution any.
I know you're leaving tomorrow, aren't you? So, like, are you pressed for time? I don't want to mess you up.
No. Oh, I'm leaving tomorrow for Orlando.
Okay.
I'm doing a show tomorrow, just an in-store signing tomorrow in Orlando, and then we're going to South Africa the next day.
Jesus.
I know. It's a whole day on an airplane, but you know what? When you do those big transatlantic flights, the airplane is usually fairly steady, and they're a little bit more generous with seat room. So I'm always getting drawing done when I fly overseas, which is good.
Interesting.
I plan to bring Flash.
Well, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, not on the plane, though. I can just see some turbulence. Oh, my God!
You can get stuff done, even on the airplane. You know, you just have to be careful where ink is concerned.
What's the occasion?
The occasion is that there are a lot of fans in South Africa, a lot of comic book fans, and they contacted me, this one store, and said, you know, we haven't really had, you know, anybody from DC Comics come over to see us, and you know, we'd like, I mean, it was really flattering. I mean, they chose me. They asked
That's
me
really cool.
Come over. And you know, not Dan DiDio. you know. So I accepted. It sounded great. And they actually, in order to afford to bring us over, they sold tickets, which is going to be weird. That means I'm obligated to draw for everybody.
Okay.
That's in my heart. But they sent over pictures of just fans wearing Green Lantern shirts in South Africa and Johannesburg.
Wow.
And, you know, listen, they put forth a lot of effort. It's worth the 15-hour flight to go over and meet them. And not only that, how cool is it to get to actually go to Africa? I mean, I don't know anybody else who's going. And we all go to Europe, you know, and
sure.
England and Italy. And, I mean, it's beautiful, but... And usually those trips are comped, and it's just part of the job. But I'll tell you something: a chance to step on a continent like Africa is rare. And I'm to be able to bring my son, who is 10 years old. It's a privilege. It's beyond a privilege.
That's amazing, man. Yeah. That really is. That's very, very cool. Will Rebirth be out there as well?
Have them, yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. They ordered. They're ready to go. So, you know, I'll go over there and I'll take some pictures. And maybe I'll write a semi-serious, column for Newsarama.
Oh, good.
About it. just to sort of explain what it was like, because I have no idea what it's like. The pictures that I've seen, it looks like Ohio. But at the same time, the hotel we're staying at is located very near a nature preserve where giraffes and, run wild. And so, we could literally wake up to a giraffe head poking through the window. I would like that to happen.
Absolutely. That's very cool. Wow, man, that is amazing. And you're right. I mean, the cradle of civilization. I mean, that's insane. That's a rare thing to happen, and that's incredibly cool. That they want you that badly, and that they're selling tickets, and actually were able to afford to bring you over. I think that's amazing.
How many tickets is that? It's a lot.
Well, and now you mentioned the Newsarama column, and I got to say that seems to be doing well. It's one of the more popular items that are on the site. People look forward to your musings, and you were telling me today that that's kind of a tough act to follow every time that you have to do a new one.
No, I just get sick of myself. I mean. I can every now and then I'll feel like writing, and it's kind of fun, but it's like the topic invariably comes back to me, because really there's nothing like I live in this. You have to understand. I mean, I think there's some people out there who really want to break into comics and must think it's pretty cool to be a comic book artist, and sometimes it is, but about 95% of the time it really sucks, because I don't leave my office. I live in this cave. And granted, there are a lot of DVDs and books and music, and everything's accessible to me, and I just sit on my ass, which it beats working. But you tend to go a little stir-crazy and focus on very tiny and unimportant things. And so that's what I have to write about. I mean, I admire people like Keith Giffen who can write humorously about important things. Or just things, issues, you know, related to the comic book industry. I have nothing to say about the comic book industry. I mean, we're 55 minutes into this interview. I've said virtually nothing.
That's not true, but
add it all up. I mean, I really am a shallow and empty man. So when Newsarama asked me to write a column, I assumed they wanted me to write my views about comics, which is dangerous anyway, by the way.
I understand.
As a comic book professional, you don't want to write too much about comics because then you're sort of forced to comment on, I don't know, the practices of others who you may eventually work with. It's just, it's not right. I mean, you know, I have nothing to say about Diamond. I have nothing to say that's interesting about, you know, Marvel Comics or DC, really, or my fellow professionals. So what I said was I'll just write about whatever I want to, and mm-hmm. I thought that would make Newsarama go away, but it didn't. So here I am, you know, writing this really bad column it used to be every week. Now it's thinning out a little bit as I am crushed by deadlines, but it's odd. It's weird that anybody would want to read anything that I write. I'm not a writer, John.
No, but you know, but you have interesting opinions, and honestly, and I'm not being nice when I say that. It's we
how
have...
come every time anybody talks about me, then they say, although I disagree with Ethan Manskai's views on this or that.
Yeah, but you don't wear your politics on your sleeve, and it's not like you know. I mean, we're on opposite sides of the political spectrum, and I love talking to you, and we have fun every time.
Why must they say? Like, at least you don't say, Ethan, I disagree with you, but everybody has to start a sentence when they're speaking to me with that. You know, it's like I have to just first say that, you know, you completely disenfranchise me in every possible way, Ethan, except when you're drawing a Green Lantern, in which case we could hang out and have a beer.
Yeah, but you're not like, you know, you're not like in Red Square, and it's certainly not in Red Square, you're the opposite, but yeah, you know, you're not like on your soapbox screaming in an artist's alley or anything like that.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, we're talking about the Sesame Street DVD and how ridiculous it is that there's an adult disclaimer on there, and we were watching it when we were 5 years old, and we're not burning down buildings.
Yeah, what is up with that? When they say, oh, you know, you watch Tom and Jerry, and I have to sit through Whoopi Goldberg apologizing for the cartoon first? Get off my effing TV.
I've seen that on the Bugs Bunny ones, man.
Oh, it's an outrage. Yeah, and you can't fast forward it, and you can't skip it. You have to sit through this ridiculous diatribe as if I don't know. You know, I don't understand the context in which these cartoons were made because, you know, I was literally born yesterday in this liberal biosphere. I get it. I understand. You know, it's like we're not upset about Pearl Harbor anymore. We got it. You know, it's like, goodness sakes.
Yeah.
Head shaking. Oh, you know, you should know that this was wrong then and it's wrong now. Well, you know,
yeah.
I'll be the judge of that, Whoopi. Please, get off my TV.
I'm hip, and I'm with you because...
Tom and Jerry, what the hell?
Now, it isn't cool when they're doing... Well, I guess I'm assuming they're talking about the maid being a black person, but I don't know.
What did she do that was, I mean...
Well, you're 100% right, Ethan.
Ankles.
I honestly, I don't know what she did either, because I don't remember... And maybe TV edited anything that truly was objectionable. I'd say the same thing about Speedy Gonzalez. I didn't believe that was an accurate depiction of the entire country of Mexico.
I did. I was really disappointed when I visited.
Don't you have people just sleeping on the road?
Yeah, I was hoping. I really liked that. I thought that in Mexico, you either ran at the speed of light or you were a slowpoke. Lied around and complained. Turns out that's only half true. Oh, I'm sorry. Edit that part.
Now, the Frito Bandito, that I get. That I can understand. I'm like, okay. You know, there you go. There's the line. I understand. And he's on the wrong side of it. And you're on the wrong side of it, Bandito.
Yeah. I find the jazz singer objectionable. I, you know, I really do. That, by the way, I bought the jazz, not the, you know, not the Neil Diamond one, which is unwatchable, but...
The first talkie.
Yeah, the very first
talkie. Al Jolson, yes.
What was anybody... You know, there are times when I go back and it's like you discover the magic of Greta Garbo. You know, like...
You bet.
If you weren't around the first time and have no idea, and you hear people say magical things about the mysterious and alluring Greta Garbo, you're able to see what they're talking about when you go back and watch, you know, Camille.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Al Jolson was a phenomenon. He was Elvis Presley back then.
Yep.
And listen, if you, you know, if you're a 15-year-old kid now and you go back and look at Elvis Presley, if you are a smart kid, you'll be able to see what the fuss was all about. There is no way to tell what the fuss was all about with Al Jolson. What an idiot. What an idiot in every single way.
And yet was the most powerful man in, like, vaudeville.
Oh, just a smack. Dope. You watch that movie, I promise you, you will take 18 showers nonstop in a row. He was just a jackass. God.
The Neil Diamond version is slightly better.
Oh, dear.
Oh, that's awesome, man. No, and you're right about that. And, yeah, I mean, it's a minstrel show. I mean, it's like, come on, man, really?
Yeah, well, the minstrel thing is weird because it keeps recurring. Like, you think it's, you know, around the time of, you know, the 1920s, maybe it died out. But no, I'm alarmingly, you know, I'm sitting here watching Bing Crosby movies, and he's...
White Christmas, of all things, absolutely.
Yeah, what was the thing that I was watching the other day? I was watching Swing Time, and I'm interested, and I'm getting into it, and I'm like, wow, this is great stuff. And then there's a minstrel show, a minstrel act in the middle of it. And it's just, I guess it was a thing to do, but I'll never understand it.
Well, I know there's a PBS vaudeville documentary that talks about a duo that were white people playing black, and they said that they were still doing theater engagements up through the late 50s and early 60s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately, yeah, 50s? I think, you know. Yeah.
I would like to see a documentary just about the blackface phenomenon itself.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah,
focus on that and explain it. Like, because honestly, I mean, people were primitive in the early 1900s. The senses of humor were dull, and their brains the size of peanuts. They were all farmers. You know, it's like
sure.
Anything would make them laugh.
Well, yeah. Or the
so I understand and excuse, but I mean, at a certain point, you know, we're fighting overseas. It's World War II. I mean, knock it off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just knock it off already. And there's no excuse for the 1960s.
Well, this is like early 1960s. Like, it's very, very early, I'm assuming. But, yeah, apparently in some parts of the country, yeah, it was still happening. Well, and even in the early 1900s, there was one famous black comedian, and I forget his name, Burt Williams, I believe was his name, and he played blackface, and he was a black man.
Really?
For real.
Wow.
And they had, like, old silent footage of him doing that stuff. So, yeah.
That's so wow. That's,
yeah. I'm telling you, man.
Something else entirely.
All right, now let's go back to Flash.
Yeah. we...
Let's get off the minstrel show.
We don't want to touch that topic anymore?
Yeah. No, I think...
Enough said.
No worries. Thank you, Stan. Well, honestly, I wanted to ask a couple things. First, specifically to the Flash... are there rogues that you really enjoy drawing? And I was just wondering, given that I've, you know, we've got the scene with the rogues, and I know they'll figure into the story to some degree. So, I mean, are there, you know, which Flash villains do you enjoy drawing?
Yeah, I like all of them except for Trickster.
Okay.
I don't like this new Trickster. He's a punk. I'd slap him.
Well, that's the point of the character, and I understand what you mean, though, too.
Yeah, don't like him. I don't know.
Do you have the abracadabra hate that I know Jeff has?
Jeff, if he hates abracadabra, it's news to me and everything he's written in Flash Rebirth because cadabra is in there.
Yeah.
And there's even a variant cover that's sort of abracadabra oriented. I don't hate him. I don't really have any opinion of him yet. He could be great. He just hasn't been yet. I like Dr. Alchemy an awful lot. I think his costume is terrible, but for some reason I like it.
Oh, I like it a lot too.
Yeah, it's just the hood with the A on it, you know, and I don't know. I think it's just cool. It's vintage, and it's weird. There's a lot to be done with him and his weird alter ego, Mr. Element, another one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Cold is Jeff's favorite. But, you know, honestly, I sat back and I watched Jeff do so much with Captain Cold, and Scott Collins' Captain Cold issues were phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Howard's, too.
You bet.
I don't feel the need to add anything. But my favorite villain of all time is Professor Zoom.
Okay.
He is a bucket of potential. I mean, it's just there's a lot there, an awful lot there.
Well, I understand it's certainly an important character through the Flash's history, and I like Hunter Solomon. I think he's fine, but at the end of the day, he's not Professor Zoom. And yeah, there was always something very personal beyond, you know, that Professor Zoom had and what he represented. And I understand. And I've always been a fan of the original as well.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm hoping to get a chance to draw him. He's in a couple of flashbacks here and there. So, you know, I'm just a fan of all of these characters. I'm excited about, you know, the possibilities of each one of them individually. I'd like to convince Jeff to scale back on too much of the Rogues attacking Flash as a group and starting to go off as individuals so that we can amp them up more as individuals, make them more, you know, independent. Because when you put them all together, this is the other thing. I'm kind of against big groups of superheroes and villains hanging out together. I don't know why. It strikes me as weird. They kind of lose their potency when they travel in large groups. I see big George Perez shots of every superhero that's ever been in the Avengers coming at me. And although it's like impressive, and it's if you really look at it as an actual image as if it were a snapshot of real life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes you just want to tell them all to go home. You're making a lot of noise. Get off my lawn. You know what I mean? So, you know, on the other hand, when you see Spider-Man or you see The Flash by themselves interacting in a real-world environment, they're scary and cool, and you can appreciate them as the unique little, you know, gem that they are. In a rough-hewn world. So I would like to see, for that reason, you know, let's take, if we're going to do Heat Wave, let's take Heat Wave and let's tell the coolest Heat Wave story that we can and make him the biggest threat possible to Barry. Because the thing about this is that as the Rogues have said in this issue, is Heat Wave, I think it was Heat Wave actually said, no, it wasn't Heat Wave, it was Mirror Master. You know, we're going to need more Rogues.
Yeah.
Barry is not Wally. Wally had kind of a sense of humor about the Rogues.
Right.
You know, I mean, we almost got to know and like these guys. They were very personable. And I don't think Barry has the same attitude towards them. I mean, he's a merciful guy, but at the end of the day, he is about justice, and these guys are dangerous and need to be taken off the streets for good.
Well, and no, I like that, and I wonder, and this is also, I'm sure, more of a Jeff question, but I'll ask you anyway. It is that contrast between Wally and Barry that makes it interesting, and will we see that kind of conversation of, you know, I can't believe you, you know, what do you mean you know Leonard Snart better than, or Smart better than, you know, whatever. And I'd like to see almost Barry and Wally have that kind of argument of how can you admire or like this guy? Don't you realize all the bad things that he's done? What did I teach you? And have that kind of conversation with him, like, you know.
I think that might be going on in Barry's head, but I can't imagine him actually speaking those words to Wally, because Wally did a good job of holding down the fort, mm-hmm. and I think he's earned Barry's respect and not too much criticism. But, I mean, the attitude that you're expressing, I think, was pretty, you know, clearly in the margins of the scene where Barry is walking out of the museum surrounded by the gigantic statues of all of these villains who sort of appeared during, you know, Wally's, you know,
run,
single-handedly owning the Flash mantle. I mean, it's like, where did these guys come from, and why aren't they all in prison? I mean, you know, I have a lot of work to do. So it's not so much like, you know, a criticism of, you know, of Wally West directly, as it is just a realization that, you know, things have gotten worse while he was away, and it's time for maybe a new sense of justice. You know, Barry believes, like, you know, like we're told in the beginning, you know, you're either guilty or not.
Well, and yeah, and he seems more driven, and yeah, it is that kind of, like when he and Hal were talking about, you know, the four different parties that were going on celebrating his return. And he's like, no, I don't have time. There's work to be done. And he wants, you know, he's back and he wants to be on the job or feels he has to be and driven in a way that maybe we haven't seen before.
Yeah, the question is, why is he back? You know, he's not, you know, he was dead for 24 years.
Yep.
Is he back to go to parties? Hang out with his friends? I mean, you know, that might be what I would do if I came back. But it's not what Barry Allen feels he needs to do. It's not why he thinks he might be back.
And Bart's, I think, reaction is the most interesting of the flashes in terms of almost resentment or almost just confusion and kind of like, you know, I don't even want to be a part of this. I you know, like, it's weird that, you know, yeah, this is this grandfather of his that he really hasn't known. And now this guy is suddenly back, and how that changes the dynamic of what he was expecting when he came back.
Yeah. Oh, Bart's so awesome. You know, I have a very emotional reaction when you talk about Bart, because he is the character that I drew when I had my son.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was drawing those comic books. I was drawing Impulse and you know, feeding my new family. So, you know, Bart is very, very important to me, and you know, Bart being treated well is important to me too. You know, I mean, I don't know if you notice. I haven't heard anything about this yet. But you know, Bart's been de-aged. I kind of watched him sort of grow up suddenly under the hands of different creators as he, you know, went from Titans to becoming the real Flash. And I bought right into it. I'm guilty. When I did the covers for a few covers for Bart Allen's Flash, I figured, well, I give up. If he's the Flash, he's the Flash. And I drew him as older and buffer, and you know, tried to not distinguish him too much from the way Wally looked.
Sure.
But you know, that was just surrender. I mean, I don't think that's what Bart Allen is meant to be. I don't think that's what people like about him. So in drawing him as Kid Flash, I've just taken my old Impulse drawings and aged them a little bit.
Okay.
Just a little bit. But it's clear. I mean, the sort of lantern-y, sort of soft, round face that Umberto Ramos created for Bart, I'm trying to make that natural and make that work so that cartoon that you sort of knew and loved is real. He said, you know, I don't want to draw him as just a regular kid. I want to draw him to look familiar to Impulse fans.
Yeah, and that's got to be tougher, especially given the shape of Kid Flash's mask as opposed to the goggles, and which lent itself to the more cartoony look of Impulse, too.
Yeah, but I'm pretty good. I can.
Yes, you are. No, you are.
I can pull it off. And he's important to me. I know him like the back of my hand. I really, you know, I'm a big fan of Bart. And so I was reading some old Impulse issues that I did because, you know, April Fool's Day was yesterday. And,
uh-huh.
And, you know, I sent my son to school with a handful of copies of Impulse number 50 to give out to his friends because that was an April Fool's Day issue.
Oh, that's cool.
And so we both sat down and reread that stuff together, and he wanted to see, you know, my son hasn't read any of this stuff, you know, so he was very excited about it and wanted to read other Impulse issues. And we did. We created all these villains, me and Todd DeZegno.
Yes, yes.
I wonder where they are now. You know, this is, working on The Flash is just, there's so many opportunities. So many opportunities to just get to do the stuff that you wanted to do for so long.
Well,
I'm hesitant to ever let it go.
Well, I was going to ask, because obviously this is a springboard to other Flash stories. I mean, you know, no matter what the outcome is going to be. So what will your future involvement be with, you know, are you going to be able to come in and do an arc here and there? Or, I mean, how's it?
We'll see. I mean, John, I'm challenging myself now to become a monthly artist.
Okay.
And you know, I know how that must sound. I think I've said before that I can't maintain a monthly schedule, and this is why I do these specials, and I hop in and out. And I think the truth is that my attitude's always been that I won't be a monthly artist because of many different reasons. One, it's not that fun to really be on that kind of a treadmill in a lot of ways. I mean, really just having to crank and constantly be worried and going to sleep and thinking about the page that you have to do the next day, to deadlines and everything, it's tough, and it wears on the rest of your life. Also, I really feel like people who are capable and who show that they're capable of producing work quickly in this industry get treated very badly. They are given the projects that seem to be the bottom rung, that nobody wants, nobody's excited about. I think sometimes editors take them for granted. I think they get low page rates. And it doesn't really make sense because, these are the guys who are kind of keeping the engine rolling.
Absolutely.
So, early on, I made the decision that I was going to be an artist who took his time and produced quality work that people would recall the next year, that they'd remember.
Sure.
So that I'd always be able to get work. And I'd try to model myself on artists like Brian Boland and Arthur Adams, who will live forever.
You bet.
Because at no point will either of those two guys go out of style. They have not drowned the industry in their work. Nobody's sick of them. They will thus always be offered work.
I understand.
Because I want to draw comics forever, I think. No? So this has always gone through my head. However, I think recently I've come to the realization that I'm a storyteller, and I really want to tell a lot of stories. And, being able to sit and draw every last glass beaker on a shelf is good, but I'm missing out on the opportunity to learn to draw quickly and learn to draw well and have the chance to tell these terrific flash stories that I have, in my head, and that I've discussed with Jeff, and whatever the future is going to be with Flash, I'm sure there is one, and the only person who's stopping me from being a big part of that is me. So for that reason, I've decided to kind of remove the "I won't be a monthly artist" and just say, you know what, I'm going to try my best and see what happens. And Flash Rebirth is a good testing ground for that because I'm getting faster.
Okay.
And, normally I might do 8 pages in a month, when I'm really just like sitting down and putting detail into everything and
sure.
At the same time trying to maintain a happy family life.
Last month
I did 17 pages.
Last month you did 17 pages?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And cover. So this is close to the requirements of that a monthly artist has to fulfill.
I understand. Well,
I'm trying to get closer, and it's a question of putting in the time, actually putting in 14 hours a day at the board, and minimalizing things. I don't, there are shortcuts that I refuse to take that I can take, and my stories will still be told well.
That's obviously the shortcuts you could do, but you just kind of feel like, no, I don't want to leave the page that way.
I'm very snotty in that way, John. I look at comic book storytelling in a way like movie making. I mean, mm-hmm. There's a high budget and a low budget way to achieve this.
I understand.
And the low budget way is to do this very quickly and just do what must be on the page. I tend to, and I think this first issue of Flash is probably my snottiest issue ever because it is super high budget. There is nothing that I denied myself.
There's a lot of detail in here. Absolutely, man.
And a lot of things that might be considered waste of time by other artists, but I love being able to do it. The opening sequence, which required me to redraw an establishing shot seven or eight times
mm-hmm.
From slightly different angles, because I wanted to do a real POV shot of a person stalking those two lab scientists, shifting on his feet and breathing until he actually walks in, until we walk in and murder them.
Yep.
But I've never seen that done in a comic before. Never seen it, but it's in Halloween. It's in all these horror movies that I like. I wanted to do it. It took a long time. But I decided I wanted to see that in a comic book. I wanted it to be mine. So, you have those choices. I mean, I could have drawn it as written found a quicker way to sort of get across that same information. But I always like to sort of create work that hopefully is slightly less disposable. Like, you can go back, John, and look, you'll find things that you didn't notice the first time in that book. You know, there are all kinds of hidden little goodies in there and doodads.
Well, that's what I'm looking at now as we're talking, and actually looking over that specific scene. I was just trying to count the panels. 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5, 6, 7, 8.
It's a few, and just
9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
You know, 15, 16, maintaining, 17, 18, 19. trying to maintain the, you know, that room without a stat. I mean, most people just draw. Just understand. I mean, if you have to draw the same sequence, a static sequence, more than once, you just use a stat. But to redraw it is pure insanity. I plead guilty.
23? Was that right? Is there more? I think 23 panels. From when we see the crime lab to the end of the kill,
yeah.
Where, and actually he's, it's, no, there's more because here come the cops and everything as I'm looking at this scene for, you know.
Yeah, the cops break it. When the cops kick in the door, the POV ends. And that's something I had Jeff add to the script because, you know, of the way I wanted to shoot it, I needed a cut to break away from the POV. If the cops pop in behind you, no, you could say, okay, freeze from behind. It doesn't work. So that was when we broke it. But, yeah, I mean, it's just a neat experiment, you know, and an experiment that, you know, when we're working on a book that focuses on movement, it was something worth trying. And there's another big experiment that's coming up at the end of this book that's never been done in a comic before either that's going to blow some minds. I can't wait. Cannot wait to do it. You know, but anyway, aside from that, I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure I can be a monthly artist. You know, if I want it badly enough.
Okay, because I just spoke to Alex Ross at the end of last year, and it was right when his JSA issue came out, that Kingdom Come arc, and he painted the inside, and I asked him, and I know that there are people who were so thrilled to see that and go, oh, why doesn't he do monthlies? Why does he always just do covers? And I know you've been given a lot of cover work as well, and people love when you do cover work. So it's interesting to hear your thought process as you're trying to figure out the artist that you can be and maintain the level of quality you want to maintain as a storyteller and yet still find a way of making that monthly you know, deadline and everything. So, no, man,
yeah.
I mean, I think people are very happy to hear that you really do want to, you know, get more monthly work and try and do more interior and storytelling work as opposed to just covers.
That's the plan. I'm going to cut out covers. I'm going to do Blackest Night covers. Extraneous covers are not going to be my thing anymore because it's just, I honestly am a storyteller. I'm not a cover artist. Somewhere along the line, I became a cover artist. I think other cover artists will tell you Ethan Van Sciver is not a cover artist. But I still do them, and I do them for my own work, which I insist upon.
Okay.
But they're just, there's nothing less interesting to me than doing a cover.
Interesting.
That's not yours. I mean, just a static image of some superheroes standing around. Where's the story? Like, where's the opportunity? I mean, you know, whenever you tell a story, you get all these opportunities to do stuff, to institute change, and to inspire and excite people with hopefully, you know, new versions, new ideas, new technique. Covers, they don't do that for me. I think someone like Alex Ross is well served by being a cover artist because he might as well paint movie posters. He's outstanding. You know, I was thinking about this the other day in the car. Just one of those things why people ask me all the time who I think, like, the best artist who's ever drawn, like, Batman is at DC. And, you know, I will immediately say, oh, Brian Bolland, Neil Adams. The truth is, it's Alex Ross most of the time.
I hear you.
Who draws the best Aquaman? I mean, you hate to say it. It's Alex Ross. Because it's like saying, who would win in a fight? Who would win in a race? Superman, Flash, or God? You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
The questions become a whole lot less interesting.
Yeah, I mean, everything that Alex draws is iconic. I understand what you're saying.
You get rid of the high end of the equation. What's that called when you take away the highest percentage and the lowest percentile, and then you find the average in between? You know, that's kind of what you're forced to do with Alex Ross. I'm a big fan of his, but
Me too.
I never really consider him as part of the game because it's like he just sort of is above the game somehow.
I hear what you're saying. I do. No, I know exactly what you mean. I can appreciate that. Now, another thing about The Flash specifically, for years, Infantino would focus on the motion and showing the wind and, you know, the speed lines and everything. And I know that the Speed Force and lightning is a big factor in this story, but it seems like that is what is also generating your depiction of the Flash. And is it individual to this story, or is it, your take on the speed and the power of the Flash?
I don't know. Somebody else made it up, and I just kind of ran with it. It's like I don't understand quite why Flash crackles with electricity. I mean, I don't understand that. It doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense to me, but he does, because we've seen it many, many, many times before.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's Speed Force crackling as it hits the air. I don't know.
Or just heat and friction, you know? I mean, that whole thing, too. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, does that happen?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know either. I mean, you know, like lighting a match or something. I don't know. Is it just him cutting through the air? And because it is so fast that it is, and it there's got to be energy involved. There is energy involved, and maybe that's why. I don't know. I'm no scientist.
We just say it's the Speed Force, and I mean that's my excuse for it. I actually love to draw energy characters, and if I went through a list of like my favorite characters, you know, both on Marvel and DC side, I mean it's like. Ghost Rider, the Human Torch, mm-hmm. Jean Grey. You know, those are my favorite Marvel characters. And what do they all have common? They're all on fire. You know, there's something neat about it. There's something majestic. There's movement that you can add without actually having your character have to move. There's motion. And at DC, sure enough, I mean, Green Lantern's energy. When I draw Green Lantern, is in motion. Even when he's not, there's movement around him. There's energy swirling, and Flash is the same way. And maybe one of the reasons why I think he's so neat visually, no matter who draws him, he's always got that cool, crackly electrical thing happening, and I think it does make a crackling noise.
Well, and even I like the difference that I see in the one panel that is the homage to Flash of Two Worlds. And you very clearly see the difference in speed of Barry and Jay as they're rushing to the guy and how each approaches it. And, in fact, I like the dialogue that Jeff has given Jay as well to say that he never really tried to run as fast as he could until Barry came along. And suddenly he found himself running faster than he had ever ran before.
Oh, that gets explained even more clearly in the future.
I can appreciate
that. I love how Jeff wrote all this stuff. It's like he says a lot of stuff without actually saying it. And if you don't understand where he's going, you might think, WTF, LOL. But really, it makes me laugh because I know exactly what he's talking about and where he's going and what all these people are going to find out. So here we go. The energy. What is it actually? We need to show a way that Barry sort of uses the Speed Force, and when other people are around him, they might also be inspired to run a little bit faster, and that's where that energy kind of crackle comes from.
I hear you.
You see Jay Garrick start to light up a little bit.
Absolutely.
And get electrical. It's symbolic, but it's also a couple of other things. Spoiler alert, we'll get to it later.
No, but that is the cool thing about this first issue, and I think it is a hallmark of Jeff's writing as well, that nothing is wasted, and all will be explained. Just enjoy the ride. And it's fun to see him with you on this series and George Perez on the Legion series as well, because I think he's tapping to both of your strengths and giving you guys enough canvas to get across your story, your ideas as well. And that's
tell him to stop with the George Perez thing, though, when you talk to him, because I got this new script from him, and he actually wrote in there, Ethan, think like George Perez for this page. Like, look at his layout. It's like, you know what, Jeff? Never say that to me again, please. I have a family to feed. It's bad enough as it is. I torture myself enough without you helping.
Oh,
my God. But yeah, he's. I mean, he right now Jeff is literally at the top of his game, and I think he's working with the very best artists. I can't believe I'm still around. You know, I've been working with him for so long that I guess I just get to be here. But you know, with Ivan and Gary and George Perez,
yeah,
many others in the future. Shane Davis, who I like a lot. Who else? Doug Monkey. Best artist in the business, and here I am right next to him.
Well, it's
just 10 years ago I was drawing Impulse and trying my best to imitate Humberto Ramos, so it's an amazing privilege, and don't think that I don't recognize it, because I do.
Excellent, man. Well, and I must ask you very quickly, because I know we've been going for like 90 minutes, and I want to wrap up, because I know I've monopolized more than enough of your time. Let you get back and, you know, have some family time, but quickly on Blackest Night, a couple teaser images came out, and I believe did Ivan draw those, Ivan Reis?
No, those are mine.
Okay, good, because I wanted to ask you specifically. I knew that they came from your designs of Black Lanterns. It was a Black Lantern version of Aquaman, and a Black Lantern version of what looks like a Superman. And I,
Superman.
Yes, okay, I wasn't sure. I figured, well, you're right, the cat's been out of the bag. Everyone saw that previews of the action figures.
I'm careful to only say what I've heard Dan DiDio say in public.
Oh, there you go, exactly, very good. Well, I want to talk about first the Golden Age Superman, because much like your Sinestro, and maybe this is something that I'm like projecting onto what I see, but there really is this kind of Teutonic Uberman Nazi kind of Superman, now that, you know, he is a Black Lantern, that seems to be there in the drawing in a way that I've never seen the Golden Age Superman look before. And I find it really interesting. But I was wondering if there was any type of, like, you know, that dark side of the Superman and the Nietzsche, you know, thought.
I'm glad there. You said that. Can I claim that was my original idea for
Please.
That one?
But really, like, the chin has always been a strong chin on the Golden Age Superman, and he has, I mean, I think it is the best character. It was so disappointing, and I understand, you know, for whatever reasons why you can't have a Golden Age Superman and a modern age Superman, but to me, I always enjoyed those stories whenever he would appear, because he is the first hero, and the burden that comes with being the first hero, and the tragedy of his death, and the times that he's gone away. I love the Earth 22 guy in JSA representing that Golden Age Superman, and yet now we see him in a way that I don't think I've ever seen. And again, it's that, in a very scary way, this dark side of you know, what the mightiest man would be if he were evil.
Yeah, I know. A noble zombie. Scary, powerful, arrogant-looking zombie, and yeah, I mean that. I don't think I had any of that in mind. I don't think I was thinking of of the Superman in terms of the original Germanic ideal. But yeah, I guess that's sort of intrinsic to the character anyway. But I really had a good time taking. You'll see some other ones. I'm pretty sure they're gonna do four or five more. I don't know.
Okay.
Just taking these characters and just making them scary. I honestly thought Marvel Zombies was entertaining, but it was ultimately a failure because it had nothing to do with anything. It was just a way of pissing on these, these very dear characters that you know. Everybody grew up. I mean, honestly, I was sickened to see Spider-Man eat Mary Jane. I understand it was kind of funny, but in a very fanfic kind of way, it was sickening to see Marvel actually do it. It was tasteless, which I understand it was meant to be. I think, despite the fact that this is a zombie kind of event, it still has class. And it means something to the characters and who these people used to be. And it's actually in continuity, which you can't say about Marvel Zombies.
Very true.
It was fun to be like, oh, you know, what would it be like, you know, if Ronnie Raymond Firestorm, you know, got a black ring? Like, what would he look like now? and just figure out, you know, where he was when he died, how he died, and then, you know, what the ring would do with his remains. And you'll see very soon.
That's awesome, man. Well, no, and I agree with you. The Marvel Zombie stuff, and I love what Arthur Soydum did, love what Sean Phillips did. Kirkman and Van Lente, I think, wrote some really interesting stories, or fun stories, I should say. But, yeah, at the end of the day, it was like Mars Attacks, the old Topps trading cards. And it was that kind of just silly grossness as opposed to, yeah, any story that it's my problem with maybe a lot of just general zombie stories. And it takes a Walking Dead or something unique done with zombies to really get my interest.
You realize, I mean, yeah, Walking Dead is the highbrow.
Absolutely.
Book. I mean, you have to understand, Marvel Zombies was compelling. It was compelling trash.
Right. Yeah, it was fun.
You know what I mean? It was like, oh, I can't believe it. It's like buying a pack of Garbage Pail Kids.
Right, exactly.
It's sort of morbid curiosity, and then you feel sad that you fell for it.
No, and it, no, yeah, well, it was fun, and I've got my hardback of the first arc and everything, and I love it, and it was cool. But, yeah, it was a fun, it was cute, it was funny.
But this is bigger.
Yeah, this isn't funny.
I think we'll outsell Marvel Zombies.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I think we'll outsell anything DC's done in 10 years. What do you think of that?
I'm all for it, man. I you know everyone is excited because you guys have been planting the seeds for this for a long time, going back to the original Rebirth arc, and we saw the Black Hand refer to the Blackest Night. We're certainly seeing the little pellets of story being told in the backs of all these issues of DC lately, where we're kind of in these origin and I forget what they're called, the little two-page stories where they're kind of looking at a character and giving you a little background and the tease of what might be coming in Blackest Night, so... It's going to be cool, but no, honestly, man, it's good to hear that those were your images, because I knew at the very least you designed them, and it doesn't surprise me now to hear that, no, those are your drawings.
I'm trying to, you know what, it hurts to kind of be away from it now. I don't know how much more I'm going to contribute to this, because my focus is on Flash, and even though I'm very jealous of Ivan, I can't believe he gets to draw this. He deserves it. He's been doing so much, but it's like,
he's awesome.
Oh my God, this was supposed to be my thing. I really, really just want to build Flash up so that we can do the same thing with the Flash in 4 years. And we'll have two big, huge, you know, DC properties that previously might not have been capable of, you know, maintaining huge Batman-level sales, JLA-level sales on their own.
I hear you.
You know, to me, this is... I, you know, we have to start kind of from the ground up, but, you know, Flash's sales were utterly in the gutters. I mean,
yeah.
I think a lot of Flash, even Flash fans were abandoning the book. But I want to get it to the point where we can do a big, huge event. We can build to a gigantic event and invite those, the X-Men fans. Are there still X-Men isn't the pinnacle, the be-all, end-all of anything anymore, is it?
I think, well, you know, it's in good hands right now. I think creatively they're in pretty good hands right now. But I as I've told Jeff a million times, and I like a lot of the guys that are currently working on the X-Men. It's never been my cup of tea. I've always been more of a Legion and DC guy. So
yeah, but I'm trying to find the book that, like, everybody buys.
I guess it's the Avengers now. I think the Avenger book. Well, and no, I take that back. Of course. Well, no, they print like 28 different like X-Men. There's always at least 4 X-Men book a month, a week. So there's got to be somebody reading, you know, all those books. Or maybe it's 7. I forget. But I remember being at the comic book store and someone going, "Do you realize there's this many per week?" So yeah, I think the X-Men does still kind of drive the train.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I mean, that's what we want. We want the default comic book readers, the people who, you know, will only read that one thing. That's all they're interested in. We want them and then everybody else, too, to come over to Flash. So.
Well, it's a good start, man. Issue 1 is sold out, and the second printing is on its way. And Ethan Van Sciver is soon to embark on a world tour promoting the Flash, going to South Africa this weekend, and that'll be...
That's correct.
And I do expect some sort of report back on that, so I think that's really cool.
I'll have to, yeah. If I'm not, you know, stolen and smuggled away, and I don't know, I'm nervous about going to any foreign country for the first time. They tell you creepy things like, you know, people steal your passports and photocopy them while your back is turned and things like that, you know. hope none of that is true. They told us that if you wore jeans in Greece, people look down on you.
And I didn't know that.
That's impossible. Well, yeah. Well, this is what Americans tell other Americans. I went over there and I said, look, I'm wearing jeans. I don't care what you Greeks think.
Good
and
for you.
And they looked at me like, what are you talking about? Well, we were all wearing jeans here. That's what we wear.
That's awesome. That's fantastic.
Sorry to come off as slightly hostile for a minute.
No, I like that a lot. I thought those were, especially being Greek, I think that's fascinating. I'm like, really? The Greeks hate jeans? That's interesting.
It's just one of those things. I mean, they will tell you. There are urban legends everywhere about every place that you're about to visit.
Oh, yeah.
Just disregard. I mean, the only thing they hate are, they hate our presidents. Maybe not this one.
I was going to say, I think you'll be okay going to Africa with this president. So
yeah,
I think everything should be all right.
Popular over there right now.
I think so.
Pretty cool.
Very cool, man. Well, listen, the book is great, and it's been fun, you know, pouring through it, and I really enjoyed hearing your observations on this first issue and what's to come, because, and I think everyone's going to be following. And honestly, yeah, I look forward to things working out that we will see more Ethan Van Sciver work on a regular basis.
Yeah, I hope so. That's the plan. And thanks, John. I love the show. I listen fairly regularly, at least when you're interviewing someone who hasn't personally insulted me, which is not that often, honestly.
Good.
I'm a big fan, and thanks a lot.
Dude,
it's fun.
Always a pleasure talking to you, and you know that. And I look forward to seeing you at one of the conventions soon.
Hallelujah.
Always happy to talk with Ethan Van Sciver. Make sure you pick up Flash Rebirth. It's sold out through Diamond, but there might still be some issues left on the stands at your local comic book stores. And, of course, second printing, I'm sure, is soon to follow. And you've seen the teaser images over at Newsarama for The Blackest Night. That event starts on Free Comic Book Day with a zero issue from Jeff Johns and Ivan Reese. Today's episode was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more from publishers like The Big Two, Dark Horse, Image, various independent publishers as well, all at discounts of 35% or more. And if you order $50 worth of product from InStockTrades.com, anything from $50 and up, shipping is free. A couple of the deals involving our guests today, both Green Lantern titles and good ones, writer Jeff Johns, artist Ethan Van Sciver, and others on the Sinestro Corps War hardback, which also features stories by Dave Gibbons and art from Patrick Olaf. The standard retail price is $24.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $15.74. And Green Lantern Rebirth, it's been a few years, but it was a great addition. $14.99 is the standard retail price. And at InStockTrades.com, you get it at $9.44. Make sure you check out their sister site, too, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-ordered monthly needs. If you want more details, check out their websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. John Suntress saying thanks. More episodes coming up of Word Balloon for the month of April, in addition to me going down to Orlando, Florida, for the FX International show. It's going to be a great show, and Leonard Nimoy is going to be there, James Marsters, Matt Fraction, Jonathan Hickman, Ivan Brandon is going to be there, B. Clay Moore, Jeremy Hahn. It's going to be a very cool show. Make sure you check out the details at their website, fxshow.com. Until next time, John Suntress saying thanks. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.